you can see, this morning I'd like to study with you about what I call approximating disobedience. This may sound familiar to you because I have another sermon, a different sermon entitled Approximating Obedience, which is looking at the idea that some people think it's adequate just to move in the direction of obeying God and maybe get halfway there or at least get closer to obeying God, and that's enough. Of course, it's not. This kind of looks at the other side of the coin. Some people go in the other direction and they think it's okay, even if they don't get all the way into what they think of as full-blown disobedience, they think it's all right to take a step in that direction. And it's not all right. In various ways, people approximate or get close to or move in the direction of disobeying God. Sometimes people may not be able to put their finger on it and say, you know, this is wrong, but it's certainly moving in the direction of perhaps getting close to approximating disobedience. What about our language, for instance? Sometimes people will use the expression, well, what the heck? And, well, you know, what is heck after all? What does that word mean? Well, it's just a substitute. It's what people call a euphemism for the word hell. Now, they don't want to say that expression, so they will substitute a word. But what are they doing in their language, in their speech? They're getting close to, they're moving in the direction of disobedience. So we need to watch our language. Sometimes we may use the Lord's name in vain. And we don't think it's wrong because so many people are out in the world doing it. You know that expression, oh my God, coming out of people's mouths. And they're not thinking about God when they say something like that. They're not praising Him. They're not praying to Him. At least oftentimes I gather that they're not, judging from the context in which they say that or the way that they say it. The question of what is modest apparel? What should I be wearing? You know, sometimes I may not be able to, you know, get it down to the exact measurement of what's right and what's wrong or whatever. But do you really want to get close to something that's wrong? So I'm just giving you an idea of what the lesson is about today. And I'll continue with a story. There is indeed an old story about a county superintendent of education who had to fill a vacancy among his school bus drivers. And he had three applicants for that job. He didn't know which to pick, so he devised a scheme to find the proper man for the job. So the superintendent took the first applicant to a sharp curve on a steep grade along the road. And he asked the first applicant, now, just how close do you think you can drive the bus to the edge of the road on this curve without going over the cliff? Well, the interested driver took a look and he replied, I believe I can get within 2 inches of the edge and, you know, still be okay, still be safe. Okay? So the superintendent took the second applicant to the same place on the road, made the same proposition to him. That applicant checked the curve and told the superintendent, I believe I can get within 1 inch of the edge and not go over the cliff. Well, as the story continues, the superintendent took the third driver to the same place, asked him the same question, and the applicant was astonished and immediately responded, do you think I'm crazy? I'm not interested in seeing how close I can get to the edge. Rather, I'm interested in seeing how far away I can stay from the edge or the danger line. I don't want to be anywhere near there if I can help it. No closer than I need to be. Well, guess which one of those three applicants got the job? Well, I think that's pretty obvious. The Bible counsels the same wisdom which was exhibited by this third applicant when it comes to getting close to sin. Some people, you know, they think that they can split the difference. Okay, you know I can't go all the way towards sin, but I'd like to have some of it. So they try to split the difference by approximating disobedience or just getting close to sin, moving in the direction of sin. They think that, they can savor some of sin's pleasures without actually sinning. So what they're trying to do is seek to satisfy both their lust, at least to some extent, and yet satisfy their consciences. They can get some of sin's pleasure, but at the same time say, well, at least I didn't sin, or I didn't go all the way. Now, there are two problems with this thinking that I can think of right now. In the first place, it's a sin in itself to get close to sin. Let me show you a few scriptures on that. In Ephesians 4, verses 26 and 27, the Bible tells us not to give the devil an opportunity. In the context, it's particularly talking about anger. But in verse 27, after having said, you need to let go of your anger pretty quickly, says, and do not give the devil an opportunity. That's really what I'm talking about this morning in a nutshell. Don't even step in the direction of sin. Don't get close to it. Don't see how near you can get to it. Because if you do, you're doing what the Bible explicitly tells us not to do, and that is give the devil an opportunity. Remember, Jesus said in Matthew, the 6th chapter, verse 13, when he was giving the model prayer, what is popularly known as the Lord's Prayer, to people, notice he did not say, do not lead us into sin. He actually said, do not lead us into temptation. That's what we're to pray for. Do not lead us into temptation. Not just don't lead us into sin, but don't lead us into temptation. Don't place yourself in a tempting situation by getting close to sin. It's noted in Psalm 1, verse 1, that the man who will be blessed is the one who does not stand in the path of sinners. It's not enough just not to walk with them. Don't even get in their pathway. In Galatians 5, verses 19 through 21, Paul lists the deeds of the flesh, what he calls the deeds of the flesh. But after listing them, notice that he says in verse 21, things like these. That's all the way up at the top there. Yes, things like these. Okay? It's not enough just not to do these things that he labels deeds of the flesh, but don't even do things that are like them. Well, that's what I'm talking about. Don't move in the direction of sin. Don't do things that even look like they're sinful. Here's an interesting passage. Exodus 22, verse 28 says, you shall not curse God, nor curse a ruler of your people. And on one occasion, in Acts, the 23rd chapter, Paul was criticized because he was thought to be in violation of this commandment because he called the Jewish high priest a whited wall or whitewashed wall. And he says, I was not aware, brethren, that he was a high priest, for it is written, you shall not speak evil of a ruler of your people. Now, notice here how Paul interprets Exodus 22, verse 28, which says, you shall not curse a ruler of your people. When he quotes it, he says, you shall not speak evil of a ruler of your people. In other words, when you speak evil of somebody, just badmouth somebody, you may be able to feel good by saying, well, at least I didn't curse him. I didn't utter any profanity. Oh, Paul understood, listen. When you speak evil of a ruler, that's as good as, or as bad as, I guess I should say, cursing a ruler of your people. Because it's approximating, it's doing what is in the vicinity of what is prohibited by Exodus 22, verse 28. Do not curse means don't even speak evil of the ruler of your people. So that's one problem with this idea. I can get close to sin and still be okay. It is a sin in itself to get close to sin. at least unnecessarily. There may be some situations where, you know, this is unavoidable, but otherwise it's a sin in itself to get close to itself. But the second problem with this thinking is that getting close to sin can lead a person to commit a worse sin or commit an open or overt sin. In James 1, verses 14 and 15, it says, "But each one is tempted when he is carried away and enticed by his own lust. Then when lust has conceived, it gives birth to sin, and when sin is accomplished, it brings forth death." Okay? So, if you put yourself in a tempting situation, you're putting yourself into a process that can end up in death. Let's look at some passages from the book of Proverbs. Proverbs 5, verse 8, for instance. Because in the book of Proverbs, the author shows concern with young people who put themselves in sexually tempting situations. For instance, beginning with verse 7 of Proverbs 5, he talks to the young man who is tempted to go into the way of a sexually loose woman, a harlot. And actually, starting in verse 7, we know that it says, "Now then, my sons, listen to me and do not depart from the words of my mouth. Keep your way far from her and do not go near the door of her house." That's basically what I'm saying in the lesson today. It says, do not go near her house. Stay far away from it. Also in chapter 7, verse 8, the author, Solomon here, is describing a naive young man who does exactly that. He goes in the direction of a harlot's house. It says, actually, beginning in verse 6, "For at the window of my house I looked out through my lattice, and I saw among the naive, I discerned among the youths, a young man lacking sense, passing through the street near her corner. And he takes the way to her house." Oh, he's just going in the wrong direction. And Proverbs 23, verse 31 there. Proverbs 23, verse 21. So do I need to advance another one? Oh, 31, I'm sorry. 31 here. We're told there, "Do not look on the wine when it is red, when it sparkles in the cup, when it goes down smoothly." He doesn't say, don't drink. He says, don't even look at the wine. Don't allow yourself to be enticed by, oh, it looks so luscious, doesn't it? Such a nice color, that beautiful red. And it sparkles in the cup. Oh, I'm just being attracted. I'm being tempted. I'm being enticed. So he said, don't even, it's not enough just not to drink it. Don't allow yourself to be tempted to drink it by admiring its color, by the way it sparkles. Let me look now at some examples of those who moved in the direction of sin and got close to it, and as a result got into sin. Now it's interesting in Genesis, the third chapter, that we have, in addition to what God supposedly said, he had told the man back in chapter 2 of Genesis, verse 17, "But from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat, for the day you eat from it, you shall surely die." But then when Eve quotes God down in chapter 3, verse 3, she says that God said, "But from the fruit of the tree, which is in the middle of the garden," that is the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, "God has said, you shall not eat from it or touch it, lest you die." Notice the words, "or touch it," are not back in the original command, a prohibition, in chapter 2, verse 17. Now, did Eve add that in, or did God actually say, don't even touch it? You know, I don't know. But either way, you know, Eve got the right concept, didn't she? She understood that, you know, if you're not supposed to touch something, you're not supposed to touch the forbidden fruit, or rather not supposed to eat it, it's not a good idea even to touch it. So Eve understood that the proper way to avoid eating forbidden fruit was not even to touch it. It would actually have been better if she hadn't even looked at it, because it seems like she was attracted by even by its appearance. But touching that which cannot be eaten, why would you want to do that? It's moving in the wrong direction. Why would anyone want to touch that which would kill him if he would eat it? You know, if you had a problem with rats and you wanted to put out rat poison, would you go up to the tablets or the rat poison? Oh, that's so beautiful. Let me just stroke it there a little bit. You know, no. You want to avoid contact with your skin. It's poison. Stay away from it. Don't get any closer to it than you have to. You know, put gloves on if you have to, or, you know, don't shake it and throw up dust in the air. You don't want to ingest that stuff at all. You don't want to get any closer than you have to. And there's the example of Abraham. In Genesis, the 12th chapter, he concocted a scheme with his wife Sarah to have the story put out that Sarah was his sister, meaning not his wife. And then, in otherwise, he was afraid that they would kill him in order to take Sarah. And he made the same statement, they say half-truth, lie, whatever you might want to call it, in Genesis 20, rather, with Abimelech. But down in verse 12, you know, he makes an effort to excuse himself. Well, he says, she actually is my sister. Let me read exactly what he says in verse 12. He says, besides, she actually is my sister, the daughter of my father, but not the daughter of my mother, and she became my wife. Okay. So, that's his excuse. Well, you know, people may wonder whether or not that was actually wrong. She was actually his half-sister, if you really want to be technical about it. But the point is, he left a misimpression with these people. And that's what he intended to do. Let me just observe here that if you've got something that's half-true, what does that imply about the other half? It's got to be half a lie, right? It's a half-lie. You know, we like to talk about half-truths. We don't much talk about half-lies, do we? But that's what a half-truth is. It's a half-lie. And getting only halfway to sin should be no more comforting to a God-fearing person than the idea of getting only halfway to heaven. Because half-truth won't get you to heaven. Might get you halfway there if you want to conceive of it that way. But who wants to get just halfway to heaven? Where would you be then? I think halfway to heaven is still going to be in hell. No? So, a half-truth is halfway to a lie, if you want to look at it. It's approximating what is wrong. Then there's the example of Lot. In Genesis, the 13th chapter, Lot, in the famous words of the King James Version, pitched his tent in the direction of, or toward, Sodom. Now, Sodom was a wicked city. So here was Lot's first wrong move. Lot made the choice of moving into the vicinity of the wicked city of Sodom. Oh, it didn't go all the way there. Didn't go all the way there. That might have been comforting to him at first. Oh, we're not going to be citizens or residents of the wicked city of Sodom. You know, we're just going to move somewhere in the direction, you know, kind of get close, so if we need to do business in the city, it won't be so far away. So, you know, we'll just move close to Sodom. But guess what? Eventually, according to Genesis, the 19th chapter, we see he's a resident of Sodom. and the other residents of Sodom give him a hard time. As a matter of fact, according to 2 Peter 2, he's vexed. He's greatly troubled and afflicted because he's living among such wicked people. So he eventually wound up suffering grievously for his poor judgment in moving so close to and then into the city of Sodom, because he experienced ultimately the loss of all that he had, even his wife, you know, who turned into a pillar of salt. And it's sad. The story of Lot is one of the saddest stories, and this is the last we ever read about him. He's living in a cave. According to verse 30 of Genesis 19, he winds up living with a cave after he escaped from the city of Sodom that was destroyed. Now imagine that. Here's a man who is tempted to move in the direction of Sodom. Apparently it was a strong city of wealth. Perhaps he felt like he could have increased his own riches by moving into the vicinity of Sodom and then into Sodom. But the irony is, he wound up living in a cave as a result of that. So the moral of Lot's story is that whatever gets a person close to sin is just not worth the risk. And I think if you had been able to talk to Lot living in that cave, he would have told you readily, I made a mistake when I pitched my tents toward Sodom. Then there's the example of Balaam that Jerry read a while ago. Here is a man who was just, he wanted to get as close to sin, right into sin, but he wanted to do it in a way that didn't involve him directly. God not only told Balaam that he could not curse the Israelites, but if you go back to Numbers 22, verse 12, he actually told Balaam, listen, if the men have come to call you, do not accompany them. Don't go with them. You know, it wasn't enough for God to tell Balaam, you know, don't curse the Israelites as the king of the Moabites, Balak, wants you to do. But listen, don't even go with them. Folks, that's divine advice that we need to follow today. It's not enough not to do what sinners do, but don't even accompany them. Well, apparently Balaam thought God would change his mind, because when some more ambassadors come back from Balak to encourage or entice Balaam to come with them, he says, well, you know, God's already spoken on this matter, but stay here, and I'll go ask God again. Well, how many times does it require for God to make himself clear? I mean, is God going to change his mind? Is God going to say, you know, I've really been thinking about this, Balaam? You know, you got a point there. I'm going to let you go there. You've convinced me that you should be allowed to go. No, God's not going to do that. Doing something which is not wrong per se, but with the hope and expectation that it will lead to sin or what you want, that so much approximates sin that it will almost certainly lead to it, because that's where the person wants it to go. That's where Balaam was hoping this would go. He wanted this so much that ultimately he lost his life as a result of trying to get the Israelites cursed by getting the Moabites to get the Israelites to commit sin. So it is pointless. We need to remember this. It is pointless to go toward an end God has prohibited. Why would you want to do that? Unless you want to disobey God. Then there's the example of David. An interesting example. David had made a commitment not to harm God's anointed. Of course, in this case, God's anointed was King Saul. King Saul was jealous of David, was pursuing David with the intention of trying to kill him. But despite that, even when Saul was delivered to him And David had the opportunity to kill him. David refused to do that. He said, I will not raise my hand against the Lord's anointed. This was God's job or responsibility. He was going to let God take care of Saul in the way that he chose to do it. David himself was not going to raise his own hand directly against King Saul. But he had the opportunity to kill Saul, and he let it suffice to just cut off a piece of Saul's robe. You know, David's conscience was so tender. Let me get over to 1 Samuel, the 24th chapter. David's conscience was so tender that he was even troubled that he had gone so far to cut off a piece of Saul's robe. He was bothered by that. So, listen. He's not going to do even that. It says in verse 5 of 1 Samuel 24, and it came about afterward, that is, after David had cut off a piece of Saul's robe, came about afterward that David's conscience bothered him because he had cut off the edge of Saul's robe. Now, think about that for just a moment. He didn't hurt Saul directly, but he was so committed to this principle of not raising his hand against the Lord's anointed that it even bothered him that he had gotten that close, that he had even moved in that direction where he could have done something like that, that he had cut off the edge of Saul's robe. He did not even want to do that. That's impressive. That's impressive. Is that sometimes what we do? We don't want to get involved in sin, but we want to reach out and, you know, touch the hem of the garment of sin. That's basically what this story tells us. Don't even reach out and touch the hem of the garment of sin. David, you know, also was later punished in 2 Samuel 24, as a matter of fact, because he had ordered a census. Somebody might say, well, what's wrong with ordering a census? Numbering the people. Well, the precedent had been set that whenever the Israelites were to be numbered, God always ordered that. In the book of Numbers previously, God had ordered a couple of censuses be taken of the Israelites. But on this occasion, David takes it upon himself to order a census. And that indicates that he is placing his trust in numbers more than in God. Now, God was the one who was going to protect Israel, not a big army or a big population to draw an army from. The example of Hezekiah. We've got a couple more examples here. The first of these last two is Hezekiah. In 2 Kings, the 20th chapter, Hezekiah took the Babylonian ambassadors and showed them all of his treasure, it says. Apparently it was a display of pride on his part. Now, some people might say, yeah, that's a pretty innocent thing. Okay, you're getting some official ambassadors here. You know, you want to show them around to your kingdom, impress them. And, you know, that's what the United States does. Well, that's what other countries do. Recently, President Trump has been on a trip around to various Asian nations. Those nations and their leaders are showing him their best. So it seems like a normal thing to do. But on Hezekiah's part, it was a display of pride. You know, that which is right in and of itself can be wrong when it's done from the wrong motive. And the last example is that of Peter. Peter showed that he was weak by fleeing along with the other apostles when Jesus was arrested. And then it says that he was following the Lord at a distance. But then he wanted to go in and warm himself by the fire in the courtyard of the high priest where Jesus was being tried. He wasn't going all the way, wasn't committing himself to Jesus, but he wanted to get close. And he put himself in a situation where he had already shown the strength he did not have. He had already shown that he did not have the strength to survive a temptation in that situation. Listen, if you know you're weak, if you know you're susceptible to sin in some area, stay away from that. Don't put yourself in situations where you're approximating disobedience, where you're getting close to it. And that's what Peter did. He put himself in a position to be tempted to do even worse. Well, in conclusion, I think we ought to recognize by now that extreme carefulness, being alert, ought to be the watchword among Christians. Paul said in 1 Corinthians 9, verse 27, I buffet my body. I keep it under control. I discipline it. Do what is necessary, lest after having preached to others, I myself should fail the test or become a reprobate, that is, be lost. Even the Apostle Paul knew, you know, you have to be careful. If you don't want to sin, then don't move in the direction of sin, because eternity is too long and the soul is simply too precious to risk its loss by even getting close to sin. It may be that there's at least one person here today who recognizes that he or she has been dallying in the direction of sin, pitching his or her tent, to use the language of the Bible, toward Sodom, and recognizes that, you know, this is wrong. This is crazy. And they ought to be like that third applicant. Remember in the story I told at the beginning? That third applicant for the school bus driver job? No, I'm not going to be seeing how close I can get. I'm going to be seeing how far away I can get from the edge. That ought to be our attitude. Has that been your attitude? Why not today, if it's not? Move in the direction of Jesus instead of in the direction of sin. Come forward in faith and in repentance to confess before us your faith in Jesus Christ as the Son of God. And be immersed, baptized in a body of water for the forgiveness of your sins. If you've done that, but since then have, well, been moving in the direction of sin, been dallying with sin, even around the edges, and you recognize, you know, this has caused you to sin, or it's brought reproach upon you as a Christian, and you recognize this is wrong and wish to come before us and make confession of your sins, won't you come forward then, as together for your encouragement we now stand and sing.